We are currently making our way through the third season of Solving JFK. Having determined in season one that the Warren Report could not be correct and that there was at least one shot fired from the front, we then turned our undivided attention in season two to the life of Lee Harvey Oswald from birth to death, which revealed that he was no lone nut. In this season three, we've been asking the question, if not Oswald, then who? Thus far, we've put some important agencies and individuals under the microscope, including the Secret Service, the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, Lyndon Johnson, and the Mafia. Next up on our list is Israel. In this series, we'll try to answer important questions about the alleged involvement of Israel in the JFK assassination, starting in this episode with the question of whether Israel had a motive for wanting President Kennedy out of office.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a
patsy. The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
I'm lurking.
He's been shot. Oswald has been shot.
I'm just a patsy.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. There are few topics in modern discourse as sensitive or as likely to be misunderstood as exploring allegations of wrongdoing by the state of Israel. In the interest of fostering good faith and open-minded conversation, now is a good time to clarify the viewpoint of Solving JFK when it comes to these matters. Antisemitism is real. It's existed for centuries, it's caused immense harm, and it remains a problem today. I don't take that lightly, and I don't approach this subject casually. Any responsible historical inquiry must be alert to the ways that prejudice can distort evidence and flatten nuance. It can turn analysis into accusation. At the same time, it must be possible, necessary even, to distinguish between a people, a religion, and a nation state. Jewish people are not the state of Israel, and the state of Israel does not represent all Jewish people. Examining the actions, motives, or intelligence services of a sovereign state does not constitute hatred of a people or a faith. If it did, then much of modern American, British, Russian, and French history, for example, couldn't be examined honestly. The most troubling allegations that we'll be discussing in this series are not that different from the allegations that historians routinely explore regarding the United States itself. Covert action, deception, governmental associations with mafia figures, and geopolitical maneuvering. To examine those actions in one country while refusing to examine them in another wouldn't be moral clarity, it would be selective blindness. When John F. Kennedy ran for president in 1960, like other presidential candidates, he courted the votes of the pro-Israel lobby, but JFK had a vague record on Israel. Unlike Lyndon Johnson, Senator Kennedy did not come to Israel's defense during the Suez Crisis in the fall of 1956, when Israel, Britain, and France invaded Egypt in response to Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser nationalizing the Suez Canal earlier that year. As author Edward Tivenin points out about JFK, quote, "He was also a Catholic. Many Jews associated American Catholics with right-wing, pro-McCarthy, and anti-Semitic causes. Worse, there was the touchy issue of the candidate's father Joseph P. Kennedy, who, as ambassador to Great Britain in the late 1930s, had been a supporter of Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasing the Nazis. It didn't help that Joseph Kennedy was once quoted as saying that there was a, quote, overrepresentation of Jews in high positions. Despite his father, John Kennedy was successful at gaining the support of New York apparel manufacturer and financier Abraham Feinberg, who, along with his associates, donated $500,000 to the Kennedy campaign. Feinberg said that when he told Kennedy the news, he was emotional with gratitude. In addition to his domestic support from the pro-Israel lobby, Kennedy also made a significant shift in how America dealt with the Middle East. Since the inception of the State of Israel, the United States had a policy that it would not sell weapons to Israel or to Arab states. This was so that America could be perceived as being neutral in the event of any conflict. Nevertheless, in August of 1962, President Kennedy decided to allow the sale of defensive Hawk missiles directly to Israel. On the surface, it looks like Kennedy was perhaps more supportive of Israel than any president before him. But when we dive deeper, there were several serious areas of disagreement between President Kennedy and the leaders of Israel. Some people believe that these disagreements were serious enough to be a motive for Israel wanting President Kennedy out of office. The first potential motive is the Kennedy administration's insistence that pro-Israel lobbying groups register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938. We just mentioned Abraham Feinberg, the man who helped finance President Kennedy's 1960 campaign with $500,000 from the pro-Israel lobby. According to Seymour Hersh, Feinberg's job was, quote, to ensure continued Democratic Party support for Israel. According to President Kennedy's close friend Charles Bartlett, Kennedy summed up Feinberg's message as, quote, we know your campaign is in trouble. We're willing to pay your bills if you'll let us have control of your Middle East policy. Bartlett said that Kennedy was upset by the level of control expected by Feinberg and decided that, quote, if he ever did get to be president, he was going to do something about it. When Kennedy was elected, he wanted to appoint Senator William Fulbright to be Secretary of State. But according to former Kennedy aide Arthur Schlesinger, Fulbright's nomination was killed because of pressure from the Israel lobby. Senator Fulbright apparently got revenge on Israel for costing him the Secretary of State job by conducting an audit in the Senate regarding, quote, an increasing number of incidents involving attempts by foreign governments or their agents to influence the conduct of American foreign policy by techniques outside normal diplomatic channels. On the heels of Fulbright's committee, on October 11, 1963, the Department of Justice sent a letter to the lawyers for the American Zionist Council with a demand to register as a foreign agent within 72 hours. The American Zionist Council refused to register after an October 17th meeting with the Justice Department. When President Kennedy died a little more than a month later, the matter of their registration was unresolved. When Lyndon Johnson ascended to power, he did not require registration from the American Zionist Council or its lobbying arm, the American Israel Public Affairs Group, or AIPAC. The second area of conflict between President Kennedy and Israel was Kennedy's perceived pro-Arab bias as compared to his predecessors. As historian Philip Muhlenbeck noted, quote, while the Eisenhower administration sought to isolate Nasser and reduce his influence through building up Saudi Arabia's King Saud as a conservative rival to Egyptian President Nasser, the Kennedy administration pursued the exact opposite strategy. One way Kennedy signaled his intentions was through his appointments. Kennedy appointed John Badeau, a scholar with deep knowledge of Arabic language and culture, as ambassador to Egypt, and named Robert Comer, an advocate of closer U.S. ties with Nasser, to the National Security Council with the portfolio of Middle Eastern Affairs. On the other hand, Kennedy also appointed prominent pro-Israel voices as well. For example, Mike Feldman was Kennedy's deputy special counsel for monitoring Middle East communications. President Kennedy's foreign aid budget was also criticized as being anti-Israel. The final Kennedy administration budget called for $40 million in aid to Israel, which was a reduction from prior years. On the other hand, in Lyndon Johnson's first budget for fiscal year 1965, Israeli aid almost doubled to $71 million. The aid package rose again under Johnson to $130 million in 1966. Under Kennedy, the allocated funds were almost exclusively for food assistance and development loans. Conversely, President Johnson called for 20% of the Israeli aid to be military assistance in 1965, and that number rose to 71% as military assistance in 1966. But perhaps the most important pro-Arab position of John Kennedy was his view that Algeria, which had long been a French colony, should be independent from France. On July 2, 1957, as a senator on the floor of the Senate, Kennedy said, quote, "No amount of mutual politeness, wishful thinking, nostalgia, or regret should blind either France or the United States to the fact that if France and the West at large are to have a continuing influence in North Africa, the essential first step is the independence of Algeria along the lines of Morocco and Tunisia." The Israeli government, on the other hand, saw the emergence of Algeria as an independent Arab republic as a threat and fought against it. In addition to opposition from the American foreign policy establishment, the right-wing paramilitary French secret army organization, known as OAS, was dedicated to stopping Algerian independence by any means necessary. The OAS viewed President Kennedy as their second biggest enemy, behind only French President Charles de Gaulle. Algeria went on to gain its independence in July of 1962 during Kennedy's presidency, which undoubtedly increased the tensions between Kennedy and his Israeli counterparts. The third area of disagreement between President Kennedy and Israel was the enforcement of UN Resolution 194, which, after the 1948 Palestine War, called for Palestinian refugees to be able to return to their land or to be compensated for it. In letters to Egyptian President Nasser and other Arab heads of state, President Kennedy expressed his support for UN Resolution 194. When Israel's Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion found out about Kennedy's communications with the Arab leaders, he wrote a letter to the Israeli ambassador in Washington saying, quote, "Israel will regard this plan as a more serious danger to her existence than all the threats of the Arab dictators and kings, than all the Arab armies, than all of Nasser's missiles and his Soviet MiGs. Israel will fight against this implementation down to the last man." In December of 1962, President Kennedy raised the issue of UN Resolution 194 again during a meeting in Palm Beach with Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs Golda Meir, who herself would go on to be Prime Minister of Israel. During that meeting, Kennedy emphasized American support for Israel, but he told Meir that the American-Israel relationship was, quote, "a two-way street." The issue of UN Resolution 194 didn't go away. After President Kennedy's United Nations delegation met with Israel on November 20, 1963, requesting continued movement toward implementing UN Resolution 194, the Israeli delegation did not agree. On November 22nd, 1963, of all days, an article in the London Jewish Chronicle said, quote, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol summoned the U.S. ambassador and told him that Israel was shocked by the pro-Arab attitude adopted by the U.S. delegation. You've heard me talk about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. I'm talking about Mood.com, which has created an entire line of functional gummies and flower crafted for your ideal mood, made with 100% federally legal THC. Not only that, but they'll deliver them directly to your doorstep so you can have your own clandestine herbal journey. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. What makes Mood.com's gummies different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. But their flower is what really blows me away. They partner with small, family-owned American farms who are custom cultivating their bud with unique terpene profiles. So you can choose a strain to help you feel more social, chilled out, or even more focused and productive. Best of all, not only does Mood.com stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you can get 20% off your first order with code JFK. So head to Mood.com and browse their amazing selection of functional gummies and flower and find the perfect one for whatever you're dealing with. Remember, use promo code JFK at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Chronological age is your birthday. Biological age is how old your body really is, and it's the strongest predictor of disease risk and mortality. True Diagnostic gives you your biological age and health markers, plus a simple personalized 90-day plan after analyzing over a million data points. Their True Age test measures longevity and aging and includes Symphony Age, tracking the health of 11 organ systems, like your heart, brain, lungs, immune system, and more. The test also gives you the top three things that you can do right now to slow down or reverse the aging process for you specifically. You can order online, and the kit ships right to your door. It's just a quick, simple finger prick at home, and then you drop it in the prepaid return package. Your only job is to follow the three recommendations for 90 days, and then you can retest to check your progress. True Diagnostic offers a one-time kit, or you can get a subscription of four tests every 90 days. So check out True Diagnostic. They use advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over a million biomarkers, and they help you identify the three most important things you can do over the next 3 months to make your health better. They're trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, Solving JFK listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code JFK20 at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code JFK20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com. We've mentioned the issues related to registration of foreign agents, Kennedy's perceived pro-Arab bias, and Kennedy's intent on enforcing UN Resolution 194. But the most serious conflict between Kennedy and Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion was Ben-Gurion's continued development of a nuclear reactor in the Israeli desert at Dimona. Ben-Gurion had been interested in obtaining a nuclear weapon for Israel since the founding of the country in 1948. On the heels of World War II, he wanted to make sure that another Holocaust could never happen. So in the early 1950s, Ben-Gurion, who was both the defense minister and the prime minister, began the methodical and clandestine process of enriching uranium without letting the Americans know about it. To lead the program, Ben-Gurion tapped Shimon Peres. To get started, Peres relied on fuel from France and a free nuclear reactor provided by President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program. In 1958, an American U-2 spy plane spotted an unusual construction site near the small desert town of Dimona. Israeli officials initially said the facility was a textile plant. Later, they described it as, quote, a metallurgical research installation. In 1960, After an American reconnaissance satellite provided a clearer picture, CIA Director Alan Dulles told the outgoing President Eisenhower that Israel was secretly building a nuclear reactor that would allow it to build a nuclear weapon. This new problem was among those inherited by President Kennedy when he took office in January of 1961. In attempting to peacefully resolve the issue of secret Israeli nuclear proliferation, Kennedy's ability to influence Prime Minister Ben-Gurion took on paramount importance. The relationship started well. When Kennedy first spoke to Ben-Gurion, he told him, quote, "I know I was elected because of the votes of American Jews. I owe them my election. Tell me, is there something that I can do for the Jewish people?" Ben-Gurion was surprised by the frankness and evaded the question by answering, quote, "You must do what is best for the free world." Despite the diplomatic niceties between the two leaders, the reality was that they had divergent interests when it came to nuclear proliferation. Kennedy wanted to stop Israel from obtaining nuclear weapons, whereas a month before Kennedy took office, on December 21, 1960, Ben-Gurion made a statement to the Israeli Knesset acknowledging the existence of a nuclear reactor at Dimona. Ben-Gurion said the reactor was strictly for research and peaceful purposes. President Eisenhower had also told Kennedy that the Dimona complex was designed exclusively for peaceful purposes. Still, Kennedy had two Atomic Energy Commission scientists visit Dimona on May 17, 1961. The scientists were not shown a reprocessing plant that was under construction underground. So at the time they reported back, they saw, quote, "no present evidence that the Israelis have weapons production in mind." When Kennedy and Ben-Gurion met in person at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York about 2 weeks later on May 30th, the Dimona plant was at the top of the agenda. Ben-Gurion stressed that the purpose of the plant was to help Israel with its lack of fresh water. If they had atomic energy, it would be much cheaper to desalinate the seawater so that Israel would have plenty of fresh water. At this meeting, Ben-Gurion agreed to annual inspections of Dimona by American scientists on terms and at times that would be determined by the Israeli Defense Ministry. Thus, there was agreement in theory, but there were no established details of when the inspections would begin or how they would be done. Ben-Gurion later told his biographer that after the meeting with Kennedy, he did not take the American president seriously because he looked like a 25-year-old boy. According to Abraham Feinberg, quote, "There's no way of describing the relationship between Jack Kennedy and Ben-Gurion because there's no way Ben-Gurion was dealing with JFK as an equal, at least as far as Ben-Gurion was concerned." In later private communications to the White House, the Israeli Prime Minister began to refer to the president as, quote, "young man." Kennedy made it clear to his associates that he found that greeting to be offensive. On September 25, 1961, President Kennedy gave a speech at the United Nations. Here's the part where he talks about nuclear disarmament.
"Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculation or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us."
In that same speech, Kennedy went on to put an exclamation on all that disarmament talk, saying that it even applied to the Soviet Union.
"And it is in this spirit that we have presented, with the agreement of the Soviet Union, under the label both nations now accept, of general and complete disarmament, a new statement of newly agreed principles for negotiation. But we are well aware that all issues of principle are not settled, and that principles alone are not enough. It is therefore our intention to challenge the Soviet Union not to an arms race, but to a peace race, to advance together, step by step, stage by stage, until general and complete disarmament has been achieved.
In light of speeches like this, it's easy to understand why Kennedy was so intent on stopping Israel from getting a nuclear weapon. While he wanted Israel to be safe from harm, it would not have been intellectually consistent for Kennedy to allow Israel to create more weapons while he publicly pushed for all other countries to do away with the ones they already had. In August of 1963, Kennedy and his Soviet and British counterparts would sign the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which banned nuclear tests underwater, in the air, or in outer space, even further demonstrating JFK's commitment to disarmament that he laid out before the UN in 1961. On the other hand, Israel's desire to have a nuclear weapon was logical, as noted by former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, who said, quote, "I can understand why Israel wanted a nuclear bomb. There is a basic problem there. The existence of Israel has been a question mark in history. That's the essential issue." In September of 1962, a second inspection of Dimona was finally allowed. But what the Atomic Energy Commission inspectors actually experienced was a Potemkin village, including a, quote, "false control room, complete with false control panels and computer-driven measuring devices." The inspectors would have been able to tell that the reactor was weapons grade if they had seen the reactor's core. But these inspectors were not allowed to see the core, quote, "for safety reasons." Kennedy, for his part, told his close friend Charles Bartlett that he was getting tired of the fact that Israeli, quote, "sons of bitches lie to me constantly about their nuclear capability." After the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Dimona reactor became a policy priority for President Kennedy once again. On April 2, 1963, Kennedy requested that Ben-Gurion allow semi-annual American visits to Dimona to ensure that it could not be weaponized beginning the next month. Ben-Gurion responded on April 25th with a 7-page letter noting that a recent Arab proclamation to liberate Palestine was, quote, "tantamount to planning a new Holocaust, since the liberation of Palestine is impossible without the total destruction of the people of Israel." Ben-Gurion followed up again on May 12th saying, quote, "Mr. President, my people have the right to exist, and this existence is in danger." Those are interesting responses from Ben-Gurion, given that his position was that the Dimona plant was not for nuclear weapons, which raises the question, why bring up defense needs and fears of military conflict when talking about Dimona if the purpose of the plant was actually solving Israel's fresh water problem? On May 18th, President Kennedy wrote back to Ben-Gurion, once again insisting on periodic inspections of Dimona and expressing his concern that Arab states would turn to the Soviet Union for assistance if Israel possessed a nuclear bomb. 10 days later, Ben-Gurion formally accepted Kennedy's request but refused to commit to any details. About 2 weeks after that, Kennedy reiterated the need to start recurring inspections of all of the Dimona facility immediately, and notably saying that American support for Israel, quote, "could seriously be jeopardized if it should be thought that we are unable to obtain reliable information on Israel's effort in the nuclear field." The day after Kennedy said that their relationship could be seriously jeopardized, David Ben-Gurion resigned as Prime Minister of Israel and Levi Eshkol took over. Prime Minister Eshkol gave Kennedy a vague agreement to a first inspection at the end of 1963, and American diplomats did visit Dimona in January of 1964, noting that the reactor had gone critical on December 26th, but that, quote, research was the present intention of the Israelis with the Dimona reactor. As noted by historian Avner Cohen, President Kennedy's murder brought an abrupt end to the pressure being applied by the United States against Israel to end its nuclear program. Next time on Solving JFK, we continue our exploration of Israel as a potential culprit in the JFK assassination, turning to questions of means and opportunity, including Israel's close relationship with CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.